Welcome to a special episode of Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. Unlike our regular episodes where we discuss individual news stories of the day, during the holidays we're doing some special episodes, and today we are talking about the legacy of Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson, the longest-serving mayor in the city's history. I'm Chris Quinn. I am here with the regulars, Laura Johnston, Layla Tassi, and Lisa Garvin. We got lots to talk about with Frank Jackson. We've all had some dealings with him at some point or another. All have had conversations with him, some of us more than others. You ready ready to have a conversation about this character, this
truly
Cleveland character?
Well, I think that Chris and Layla will have the most to say about.
Yeah, and I will have the least to say
about
it.
Yeah.
Oh, let's see how it goes. Let us begin. How much does it mean for Northeast Ohio that for 16 years, the person at the helm of city government did not have a whiff of corruption or dishonesty? Is that kind of integrity something we should take for granted? Is it really something worth celebrating? Laura, every time we talk about Frank Jackson over time, we talk about, well, he's honest. You know, he never lies to people. He doesn't have any corruption around him. And it always strikes me that we talk about that like it's remarkable, but in Northeast Ohio, it really is remarkable. How big a deal is it?
I mean, I agree with you. This should be the baseline that we ask of our public officials, that they are honest to us. But you are right. We live in Ohio. It's not just Northeast Ohio. There's a lot of corruption all around. And I do think we've taken this for granted with Jackson administration. Obviously, he has been mayor since 2006, 2005. I mean, I guess we're counting back 16 years here, but that's before I started at The Plain Dealer, and we have had dozens of scandals in that period. I mean, Cuyahoga County has been embroiled in two big ones, including one that sparked an entirely new form of government. So meanwhile, we had this very staid city hall where the biggest scandals were pretty low level. There were a bunch of building inspectors that got busted. There was a construction manager, but for the most part, Jackson made sure that his employees and himself were held to the highest standard. And Jackson said once, and I looked back at a bunch of clips, he said it should be very clear to people what is proper behavior, what is improper behavior. He said that about the building inspector scandal, and he kept his word. No cloud of scandal. I don't always agree with Ted Dieden, one of our columnists, but I'm 100% with him on his take about Jackson in an editorial roundtable. He said Frank Jackson was mayor for so long that it became easy to take his honesty, integrity, selflessness, and other admirable human qualities for granted.
Well, you know, I've been doing this for longer than I care to admit, and the number of politics, and I've talked to a lot of politicians, I still do, the number that I can say truly never lied to me, I could count on one hand, and he's one. I mean, you know, we've had knockdown, drag-out fights with his administration over the years, but whenever we've had the conversation, he's not lied. He's a truth-telling guy, and it is striking in my history to have somebody of that kind of integrity. I just think it's odd that we talk about it this way. Because...
Well, that's the thing. I don't think we take it for granted. I think we talk about it all the time. But, you know, avoiding corruption while in office and running a city with integrity shouldn't be praiseworthy achievements. That's what you're supposed to do. You shouldn't get celebrated for doing what you're supposed to do. I mean, it's like when my husband takes the kids with him to the grocery store and people look at him like he's father of the year. No, they're his kids. That's what he's supposed to do. So maybe we've just reached a nadir in our politics where retiring from a career without getting indicted is a noteworthy accomplishment.
Although that's pretty sad, but...
but
take it one more step, though. Even for people who are honest, a lot of people who are in politics leave office considerably more wealthy than when they started. And there are others who have not. You know, Sherrod Brown has not become a billionaire while in office. There are others that do the job and take the pay. But Jackson, I don't think you could ever say Jackson was mayor for himself. I mean,
right.
He did serve others. And that is part of the integrity. Anyway, it's fascinating to me.
Can I just add... He's always honest, but I don't know that he always answers every question. You know, like he's obviously right. It's not like he'll honestly answer every question. He'll just tell you, you know, he's not going to answer that.
No, he holds his cards very close to the vest.
Right.
I mean, I think that's what's kind of surprising is after 16 years, for most of the population, he remains an enigma. I've had the odd situation where I've had a lot of conversations with him and I've kind of seen behind that veil, and he's a fascinating guy, but almost nobody has seen that side of him. So you're right. He doesn't always explain what he's doing, but when he does, he tells the truth. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Let's talk about how Frank Jackson tackled education, something we had talked about in his first inaugural address. Today, we toss off references to the transformation plan as if it's just another policy. But let's talk about what it took to make this happen. Lisa, I think you could argue that the transformation plan may be his single biggest piece of legacy. It'll be interesting to hear what Layla and Laura think about that.
I was going
to
say, but, I mean, I've just been back here since 2017, and my impression of Frank Jackson in the couple of board meetings that he attended, that yes, he was a little bit prickly and didn't always answer questions. And I asked him a lot of direct questions, and I guess Betsy Sullivan, our opinion editor, and said, "Who is that woman asking all those questions?" And I'm like, oh,
that's a good thing.
But anyway,
let's talk about education. So the transformation plan is a big deal. What did it take to get that done?
It happened in 2012. It was the Cleveland Plan for Transforming Schools, where he worked with the Cleveland Schools CEO, or whatever his title is, Eric Gordon. And they basically, you know, wanted to base pay on teacher performance, share property tax revenues with charter schools, and retain high performing teachers. But he had to work through a GOP-dominated legislature to get some of things pushed through, and then Governor John Kasich. And during his tenure, he also got two property tax increases approved to help the schools. But yeah, so I would say that that's probably his keynote achievement, is this plan for transforming schools. We've seen some progress. Obviously, there's more to come. And then we can't forget Say Yes to Education, which is a national program that came to Cleveland in 2019, offering wraparound services and free college to high school graduations. Progress has been slow, but it has been measurable.
Well, progress has been slow, but before we did this, there was no progress. Mm-hmm. So every year it ticks up a little bit. Layla, I was surprised when I went back. You had asked the question last week when we were doing all this profile stuff, and I looked at his original inaugural address, mm-hmm. and he was talking about having to make a dramatic improvement in education.
Yeah.
Do you agree that that is probably his signature achievement?
I think so. I mean, I think that's why he ran for that last term. You know, he said that was one of the things that he just couldn't leave unfinished. He wanted to see that through and take it, you know, as far as he could. But, you know, the trouble is poverty, because, you know, kids experience so much trauma associated with poverty, and it has a profound effect on their experience of school and their ability to thrive. And the district, you know, God bless it, does so much to try to mitigate the impact of that with these wraparound services and with the structure set out in the Cleveland plan. But truth be told, you can hire the best teachers on the planet. You can build the shiniest new schools. You can provide all the finest learning materials. But the impact will always be limited if students, when they leave school, are facing hunger and housing insecurity and violence in their community or family, or any of the destabilizing effects of poverty. I mean, Jackson really understood that. And I think that's the underpinning of his famous line, "There are no silver bullets." You know, fixing the schools requires addressing the impact of poverty, too. And he's tried to do that in other ways.
Yeah, he's tried to do that, and he's battled what he calls the beast, the people that profit from the fact
exactly.
that poverty remains. But look, he was the first one. Once mayors got control of the schools, he's the guy that put in an educator as the CEO. We had two people that were la-di-da kind of dancing around. One became a criminal in Chicago.
Ugh, yeah, right.
By picking Eric Gordon to be the CEO, Eric Gordon is a true educator. You know, we've been dealing with Eric for a long time, and I think we all believe he is the mm-hmm, best thing that's mm-hmm. probably happened to Cleveland schools in decades. You know, and you're right. The Cleveland schools have a monumental challenge, and they do try to do lots of things. We've got a project we're working on now where we're hoping to illustrate how they tackle these special challenges
right.
in the follow-up to a greater Cleveland. I do think what Lisa mentioned about how he had to work with a Republican governor and a Republican legislator to transform the schools. He had to work with a very combative teachers union to get some things done. And in a time where people had no money, he persuaded people to pass taxes to do it. 1 year. Mm-hmm. Remember the 1 year? He not only got them to do the education tax, he got them to approve the income tax increase. I mean, it's kind of staggering his credibility with the people to get that done.
Right. And even during a pandemic, they approved the not only the renewal, but a bump up in the tax. And so, I mean, Clevelanders care about this problem. And yes, bringing Say Yes to Education to Cleveland has the potential to be a game changer, too, for so many Cleveland students. I mean, attending college for free, what a program. I mean, yeah.
I do think when you look back, that's going to be one of the things that people do continue to talk about. It's Today in Ohio. Frank Jackson is known for loyalty to those who are loyal to him, and that has resulted in less than stellar minds populating key positions at City Hall. The worst of the lot was probably Mike McGrath, the former police chief and safety director. Layla, you covered this administration for a good number of years. You were facing with some of the people he was loyal to. How did Jackson's loyalty impede progress in the city?
I think that is probably the most frequently cited flaw of Frank Jackson. You hear it all the time. He's loyal to a fault. And often it's cited as really the only plausible explanation for the survival of a handful of city officials who are doing little more than just punching a clock at City Hall, right? But in the case of Mike McGrath, that loyalty has cost the city more. I mean, McGrath retired in 2020 after 48 years in law enforcement, 9 as chief, and the last 6 as safety director. But weeks after McGrath's retirement, the monitor overseeing the process of reforming Cleveland's police department under the federal consent decree released this discipline audit that found that McGrath was often lenient when officers had committed these terrible acts of misconduct that deserved more severe punishment. And the cases the monitor was talking about occurred well into the reform effort. And Jackson has stood by McGrath for more than a decade on the grounds that McGrath was a disciplinarian who enforced accountability among the rank and file, despite clear evidence of his laxity before and after the consent decree was implemented. I mean, remember that story from years ago where we found that McGrath had ruled just about every single taser case to be warranted? And remember when we saw all those officers chase those people into East Cleveland and kill them in this hail of gunfire? Mike DeWine was the attorney general at the time, and he declared that to be a systemic failure. That should have fallen squarely at McGrath's feet. And yet Jackson not only rejected calls for McGrath's dismissal, he promoted him to safety director. His rationale was McGrath was the only person who could drill accountability down into the rank and file, and that he was the only person standing in the way of a complete whitewashing of that shooting. Later that year, Tamir Rice was killed by police on McGrath's watch. So yeah, in a discussion of the harm that Jackson's loyalty has done, I'd say Mike McGrath is the perfect place to start.
Well, and we were all over it. I mean, we did multiple projects about police use of force. Our work was used by the Justice Department in its petition for the consent decree investigation because we were all over it. And I'll never forget sitting in the room with these guys and they're defending themselves. I mean, that you mentioned the taser case. It was like 98% or something of the taser use was justified. And when you look nationwide and talk to experts, that was impossible.
Right.
That's just not, that's not possible that could be that high. There are huge studies about it. And yet they sat there and they argued. And you're right. Jackson repeatedly said McGrath is the only guy who's actually seeking to discipline officers. And I'm standing by him. We called for him to get rid of him. Everybody called for him to get rid of him and he wouldn't do it. Right after he retires, that report comes out that just kind of debunks the entire Jackson mantra.
But along with McGrath, you got to talk about Marty Flask, you know, also a former chief, right? Wasn't he the chief at one point, a safety director? He retired a bunch of times and is by now, I don't know, a quadruple dipper or something like that. But Jackson just kept assigning him to special projects just to keep him around for a while. When I covered City Hall, there was like a little desk set up for Flask in the mayor's office. Like it was bring your son to work day or something like that.
No, I think you're missing the point there. I think Jackson, because he was loyal to some people who weren't competent, He relied on Marty Flask to be his cleanup man. Hmm. You know, when he needed had a problem at the airport,
well,
Marty Flask went out to clean it out.
Perspective.
I think Jackson relied on the competence of Marty Flask to get to the bottom of things and clean them up. And I think, look, Flask could have retired long ago. I don't think he wants to work. I think he's continued to be there because he feels some loyalty back to Jackson. But you can't get beyond the idea that he had a group of people that he's been loyal to, not all of whom are the best people going. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Right up there with education, one of Jackson's most significant accomplishments was the finances. While Detroit went bankrupt during the Great Recession and other cities chopped services, Jackson and his finance director, Sharon Dumas, who I think all of us found is hugely competent, kept things running. How did they do it, Laura?
Well, it was not easy because aside from this recession, remember the state under Governor John Kasich obliterated the local government fund that had gone to cities since the 1930s, cut other funding to cities. So Cleveland began losing about $30 million each year since before the 2008 recession. So, I mean, this was not an easy task and it wasn't flashy. You could call it penny pinching. The recession did force some layoffs and service cuts, especially in police officers, firefighters, and EMTs, but the city survived. By law, Jackson must present a balanced budget. And a few years he did this by moving millions of dollars carried over from one year to the next. But he would come every year to the editorial board at the newsroom and present these giant spiral-bound budget plans and go through them very methodically. And he said, "I'm fiscally conservative," during a meeting in 2011. He said, "It's common sense to me." And that was in the midst of when these big cities were having a major crisis. So he was slow and steady, just like everything else he did.
Well, we were ground zero for the foreclosure crisis. It ended up getting worse elsewhere, but we were the place that it was worse. The recession hit the cities hardest. What always struck me, and it was great that he would come in and go through the budget each year. That's how we got to know Sharon. She'd come in and we were like, man, she's the best. But he would always lay out that he doesn't have a balanced budget, that the only reason the budget was legal, because in Ohio you have to have a balanced budget, was the carryover from the year before. Mm-hmm. But if they didn't have the carryover through attrition and savings and dark time with unfilled positions, they would have spent more than they were taking in. And it was getting worse and worse each year. And what I appreciated about him is probably 3 years before he had to go to voters for the income tax increase, he said, "That day's coming." He said, "Look, I keep doing this. I keep taking the carryover money, and that allows me to say my budget is balanced, even though we're not. But the day's coming where that's not going to happen. Kasich has robbed cities blind. I mean, he took so much money away from cities to fund rural areas and tax cuts."
Well, to balance the state budget. I mean, Kasich was still like, "I balance the state's budget. Look, I created a rainy day fund because you took it from the cities."
Well, he violated the whole idea of the tax structure in Ohio was based on creating a local government fund that had been there
the
for decades,
tax.
And he sucked it dry. I mean, he really stuck it to the cities, and Jackson kept pointing it out. Like, you know, if we had that $50 million that the state has sucked away from us, we'd be okay. But we're losing that. We're losing this, and he prefaced it. And the 1 year right before the income tax year, he went through the budget and he was in a bad place. And I remember him kind of picking it up and letting it just drop on the table and say, "You know, am I happy about this? I'm not happy about this. It's what I got."
And very pragmatic. I mean, and that sums him up, right? He was a pragmatist. And so that income tax increase, it was in 2016. It went up from 2% to 2.5%. That was an additional $80 million a year. 87% of that is from commuters who live elsewhere and didn't get to vote on this. But it didn't put them out of whack with a lot of cities in the areas. And obviously, we have a very complicated income tax system here where it depends where you pay into when you live. But I mean, I think this is going to be one haunting thing of Jackson's legacy when he leaves, right? This income tax and what happens when the commuters don't come back.
Well, a whole bunch of people are going to be putting in for refunds for 2021. They're probably going to have to write tens of millions of dollars of checks. Layla, you remember when the income tax increase went into place, suddenly the city had money, real money, that there was no longer, you know, scratching it together to get things done. And he did largely live up to promises. Immediately, sidewalks started getting replaced and rec centers got some investment. The stuff that he had said he would do if he got that money, we paid attention, and he largely did come through, right?
He did. He did. I mean, honestly, I'm still stunned that he was able to persuade voters to get behind that. But, but again, like, an income tax is largely paid by, you know, people who might live outside the city. So voters were okay with that. And, I don't know. I think overall, I think that the balancing of the budget will be one of his crowning achievements, you know, specifically Sharon Dumas's accomplishment. And it's one of those achievements that isn't sexy or flashy. It's survival. And people take that for granted. But think of all the hard times, the recession, the pandemic, and the city is still okay. And I think that will be a major part of his legacy. He is, though, like Laura said, getting out just in time, because who knows what's going to happen if commuters don't come back.
He did have to become an astute student of the budget. Look, you mentioned that he got people to pass that tax. I do think that the people of Cleveland, the voters of Cleveland, trusted him. It's why he got reelected four times. When you think about him getting reelected after police killed Tamir Rice, and I mentioned this in a previous podcast, I think in most cities that would be the end of the mayor. That's such a devastating thing. But the voters trusted him. I mean, I think they would have elected him as long as he ran, and he did get them to pass taxes, which is staggering when you think about it. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Apart from finances, the biggest challenge Jackson faced was policing. He was mayor when just about every cop in the city engaged in a reckless pursuit and a reckless hail of gunfire in East Cleveland. And like I said, he was mayor when his own police shot and killed 12-year-old Tamir Rice. He's also the mayor who worked with the Justice Department on police reform. Layla, I know the police reforms are not complete. Voters clearly made that clear when they voted to have more civilian oversight over discipline. But what do you think his record is on policing?
Well, you know, the city's been under this consent decree since June of 2015. It was originally anticipated to be a 5-year process. And for a few years, the city kept saying that they would complete all these reforms in 5 years. Then, I don't know, sometime around 2018, it started to become clear that wasn't going to happen. And today, it feels like they're not really that close. So, I mean, early on, the city took some major steps in a few areas. They improved training on proper use of force and dealing with the mentally ill. Those were critical needs in the department. And that alone did lead to a drop in use of force cases. But, you know, the Office of Professional Standards, it also worked on reducing its huge backlog of cases, too. But the Internal Affairs Unit, which investigates officer misconduct, remained understaffed for years into the consent decree. I'm not entirely sure that's been addressed. Then came the true test of how things were going when protesters arrived downtown after the death of George Floyd. And police basically failed that test. I mean, any hostility that was erupting in that crowd was exacerbated by the police behavior. They were just firing tear gas willy-nilly, blasting random people with rubber bullets. One guy even lost his eye. I mean, they even fired on people who weren't involved in the protest and were just headed to their apartments downtown. We were this deep in the reform effort.
But let me push back, though. A lot of that misbehavior wasn't Cleveland police. The sheriff's department did misbehavior.
That's true. You're right. You're right.
And the guy that was fired on by paintballs, it was suburban police. Look, I get that the whole investigation of police misconduct has not been good. That's why voters overwhelmingly said, we're done with you. We're going to put civilians in control. But go back to the beginning of the consent decree. We had wild cowboy antics on the street.
Right.
That chase into East Cleveland, I've never seen anything like it. It's amazing that they didn't kill each other as they stood in a circle. The police relationship with the residents was horribly broken. Nobody trusted the police. So in the early years of the consent decree, police got a ton of training. And I think that we saw the result of that in 2016 at the Republican National Convention, when there were a few exceptions. It was largely a very positive experience.
It was.
You saw police interacting greatly with the million people who were there for the Cavs victory parade. The consent decree also got police much more of the equipment they needed. Remember what the original investigation said? that the residents viewed the Cleveland police as something like an occupying military force. That doesn't really exist in that form today. There's miles to go, clearly miles to go with this police department. But I've been here a long time, and it is a far better police department today than it was before 2014.
Oh, I mean, you know what, though? I think that one of the key problems, though, is that the Community Police Commission has a terrible relationship with the city. We've learned that they, you know, the city has continued to fail to turn over documents and data when it's needed for the commission. The commission has said that the city obstructs their efforts and sees the relationship as an obligation rather than beneficial to improving policing. I mean, the judge had to mediate some of those disputes. Then there was infighting and conflict, and the consent decree monitor bent to pressure from the police and forced the resignation of his deputy monitor because she made some comments on the radio or something like that after George Floyd. I mean, and then groups were calling for his removal. But perhaps the biggest sign that the reforms aren't fully there, as you said, Chris, is the overwhelming voter support for Issue 24. I mean, that creates this powerful citizens panel to oversee policing, including discipline and investigations of officer misconduct. And people are fed up with this process hitting the brick wall, and we are so deep into it. So now a major portion of it will be in the hands of the people. That's the outcome of that. And
in the hands of Justin Bibb. I mean, he's a big believer in the police reform movement. So maybe he can complete the journey that was begun with the consent decree. We'll have to see. Like you said, there's a long, long way to go. You're listening to Today in Ohio. The human race is destroying the planet, as anyone who is paying attention knows. So the fact that Jackson worked to make the city a leader in sustainability is not nothing. There's a long way to go, and you could argue, Lisa, that he didn't have a lot of successes, but there were some. What were his aims, and what did he do that actually might have some kind of long-term effect?
Well, I think the most recent thing was the LEED Silver Award. This is the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. They got that from the U.S. Green Building Council last month. They got 57 points out of 110 points. They got really good scores on water efficiency, resiliency of the grid, and other things, you know, dealing with hazardous materials events, severe weather, IT disruptions, and so on and so forth. Also, transportation and land use. We have low average vehicle miles, but the fact that they got the silver award, that not many cities get that every year. And also too, he has a chief of sustainability, Jason Wood, who's been working on various things. He wants to have recycling in Cleveland. It got disrupted by the pandemic. They're trying to start it up again by doing like an opt-in instead of an opt-out. And then they had a sustainable, you know, Cleveland summit. I guess they had a couple. There was one that was virtual because of the pandemic. So I think he really wants to look at the connection between the environment and social justice issues. I mean, Cleveland is a town where, you know, highways were run through black neighborhoods and, you know, neighborhoods were cut off from the lakefront. So I think he wants future projects to have an eye towards how it affects not only the environment, but the people that live in those neighborhoods where these projects are taking place.
Yeah, there are light years to travel on this path for Cleveland and all American cities. The fact that he invested some time in trying to get people thinking about it is laudable. We'll have to see if it goes somewhere in future administrations. It's Today in Ohio. Okay, let's close out with this. Jackson's been an enigmatic political character, as we said, as Mark Vosburgh wrote in his terrific survey of Jackson's career over the weekend. We didn't see a lot of his private side. What after all these years of dealing with him, what do we think made him tick? Layla, let's start with you.
You know, you and I have both been in many meetings with this guy over the years, and I think it's fair to say that his sincerest moments were when he spoke about his desire to find ways for the underserved communities of Cleveland to share in the prosperity that others were enjoying in the city. He was passionate about creating opportunities economic benefits agreements with developers and with the big institutions that were building their companies within the city. He saw that as the path to a more hopeful future for many Clevelanders and a potential solution to some of the deep social problems that give rise to crime and violence. I think that was perhaps the underpinning of just about everything Frank Jackson set out to do.
What about you, Laura? What did you think?
I really think he went into politics and government for the purest of reasons, and that is to make his city a better place. He didn't try to springboard into a bigger political career or ever run for bigger office or statewide office. And I mean, it was kind of joke, right, that he would say it is what it is, to the point that he stopped saying it in public. But I think he was a pragmatist. He saw the world for what it was, and he wanted to work in his own way to make it a better place. And I think Layla's completely right when she talks about that he wanted to do things for the least of us. And I think he was just motivated by good. And I don't think he cared very much what outsiders thought of him or of Cleveland. And maybe that's why he ignored public records for so long. He's like, I know I'm doing the right thing. I don't need to worry about showing this to other people.
Yeah, he was terrible at public records. Lisa, you have a different perspective because you weren't in Cleveland for most of his time. And your perspective on him is he's kind of a crotchety guy. Didn't answer your question.
Right. And the fact that you said that he holds his cards close to his chest is a very apt, description of him. And I found, through his interactions with the editorial board on certain things he wanted to promote was that I felt like sometimes he wasn't a leader. I felt like the mayor should be the one bringing all the disparate public-private efforts together. But he seemed to want to let them do that, like the Cleveland Foundation and other groups, to forward. And I felt like he should have been like the man, the umbrella under which all of these other things took place. So I at first viewed it as a lack of leadership, but I guess I don't know what to think of it now. But, I think I understand it better that maybe he thought that they should work this out among themselves. But I feel like the mayor, for any big project or any big initiative, the mayor really should be the one that everything funnels up to. But I felt like he kind of, abdicated a little bit there.
I don't think anybody has a vantage point like I've had. I've been dealing with him for 22 years since I was a reporter, and I've had many off-the-record conversations with him. And I got to tell you, I don't think he cared about some of that stuff. I'll never forget when Opportunity Corridor first came up. This is 20 years ago, and it was originally going to be a highway taking you from the interstate right into the University Circle. And he had become council president, and we were having monthly or bi-monthly off the record. Well, no, these were on the record sessions, I guess. Me and Mark Vosburgh were covering him then. And it was pretty exciting. The idea of Opportunity Corridor, a road to finally connect University Circle where all these people work to the interstate. And I'll never forget it. It was like, yeah, I don't care about that. I just don't care. He says, if they're going to do it, they're not going to make it a highway. It'll be an at-grade road with intersections into the neighborhoods so that the people who live there benefit from whatever the development is. I'm not just going to get behind a highway in, but it's not my thing. I got other stuff I want to get done. And that is what my lasting impression is of him. He started with a purpose. I mean, Laura touched on this, Layla touched on this. His purpose was serving the people of Cleveland, a lot of whom are in poverty. And he never veered from that. He didn't care what people thought. He never got buffeted by public opinion. He listened to people, and then he made up his mind and he did his thing. But he wasn't going to lead the kind of effort you're talking about, Lisa, because it didn't really fit in his purpose. He would do what a mayor does if people came to him and said, hey, we got some thoughts. But he just didn't care about that.
I'm going to change the subject just slightly, but I think the thing that really stuck out to me about Frank Jackson is that he always stayed in the central neighborhood. And as many of us know, that's not the safest of neighborhoods in Cleveland. And he stayed there throughout. And I think a mayor that doesn't, haul ass to the nice part of the city or whatever, that shows a dedication to me, is that, it's his neighborhood, he's staying, and, so be it.
I've dealt with a lot of politicians. I've never dealt with anybody like Frank Jackson. He is one unique public servant. Go ahead, Layla. I have the last word.
I wanted to add, you know, that some of the more memorable conversations we've had with him over the years were about how he understands the fear and anxiety of Cleveland parents and how deeply he cares for the city's kids. And when parents send their kids out the door and hope they come home safely, you know, he said he understands that. He's experienced it. I remember him telling us how he looks at the clock each day and recognizes that his grandkids are being released from school and that he was anxiously awaiting the passage of so many hours during which, anything could happen to them out in the world. And you know, I think that's why he survived also through his career survived the Tamir Rice shooting, because he was his response to that, he was tearful at the news conferences. He has always cared, and it was all personal to him. That's why he ran for office in the first place, because he cares deeply about the city and its future generations, and he just couldn't leave it to chance. And that's what I'll remember about him.
Right. He walks out the door with his head held high. He's been a public servant for most of his adult life, and now his time has come to an end, as has this special episode of Today in Ohio. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Layla. Thank you, Lisa. Thanks to everybody who listens. Our regular podcast will return on Monday, January 3rd.